Let's go to the Hebrews in chapter 11, a familiar paragraph. Hebrews in chapter 11. And we read the section concerning Moses, but just first of all, the first verse, Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Verse 23. By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. By faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God, than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Through faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. And that's as much as we propose to read tonight from the scriptures. I think you would all expect that in a week of meetings in which we would be speaking upon critical choices and their consequences, it is practically inevitable that at some stage we would turn to this passage in Hebrews chapter 11, bringing before us the tremendous choice of Moses, choosing rather, as we have read, to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. If ever there was a choice that was critical, and if ever there was a choice that had consequences, well, to be sure, it must be this one. When Moses made this choice, his life was unalterably changed. The next 80 years would be totally different from the previous 40, just because of this choice. Not only did this choice have a tremendous impact upon the man who made it, but it touched the nation. Because a little further down the line, the exodus of the nation from Egypt, it sprang from this choice. It touched a man, it touched a nation. And I do not think that you'll imagine I'm exaggerating when I say it touched the world. Human history, the configuration of the nations of the world, the politics, the writing of history books, they've all been changed because of this choice. A man, a nation, the world, and one choice. It's enough to teach us that our choices can have tremendous effects not only upon ourselves and our families and the assembly with which we are associated, but it can have effects upon generations that are yet unborn. Choice, the power of choice, is amazing. And yet the possibilities of choice are very, very alarming. Now, before I come to just look at particularly the center of this little paragraph, I want to think for just a few seconds about the book in which it's found and its relation to this, not the book of Hebrews. I'm not going to give an opening of it at all, but the book. And then I want to think a little bit about the chapter, and then a little bit about the paragraph in which this choice is related, the paragraph concerning Moses. And then we take a close look at the choice itself. Now, as far as Moses is concerned, you will likely already know that he, with Abraham, each of them is mentioned 10 times in the epistles of the Hebrews. Moses is a figure who cuts a very imposing sight
on the landscape of Bible history. He gives us the first five books. His name appears in the New Testament, I think possibly more than any other Old Testament character. He's spoken of in the New Testament more than David. He's spoken of more than Abraham. And as I say, 10 times we have a reference to him here in the Epistle to the Hebrews. If this epistle, as we think, was sent to people who in background were Jewish and had turned to Christ, it's no surprise to us that the writer makes so much to do of one of the great heroes of Hebrew history. For example, if we turn back to chapter 3, the main emphasis in chapter 3 is Moses and his fidelity. It tells us there most beautifully that he was faithful. A lovely word. He was faithful in all God's house. If we turn, for example, to chapter 8, it tells us when Moses was given the details of the furnishings of the God said, now you make sure, sir, you do it all according to the pattern. Well, a faithful man in chapter 3, he got the furnishings in chapter 8. If we turn the page or two to chapter 12, and all those thunders and lightnings of Mount Sinai, Moses said, we don't get this in the Old Testament, but we have it on the page of the New in Hebrews. He says, I exceedingly quake and fear. Moses and his fidelity. Moses and his furnishings. Moses and his fear. And of course, you can supply the fourth one here, the fourth major passage to do with him, chapter 11, Moses and his faith. So even in this one New Testament book, we are given quite an all-round picture of this famous and very important Old Testament character. Now, as I say, that brings us to this particular chapter. The whole subject, as we know so well, is the importance of faith. You know what makes a man's life different? Whether you think about the days of Abraham, whether you think about the days of Moses, whether you move into the days of the judges, or whether you think about our own day, it's faith. Faith is shown in Hebrews chapter 11. That is faith in God, faith in the Christian sense, faith in the Bible sense. Faith is shown to be a dynamic power. It's not something static. It's not something theoretical. It's not something merely mental and intellectual. And it's not something dead. But once faith is firmly placed and planted in a person's heart, it revolutionizes his life. The dynamic of faith, this forceful principle that has moved the world for God, and of course, the poverty of our life, is just unfortunately the exhibition of unbelief. And it is refreshing to come to see the force of faith written right across Hebrews chapter 11. Now what is faith? What is faith? Well, to put it in very, very simple terms, and that's why it is brought in at this stage in the epistle to the Hebrews. Faith is human response to divine revelation. Now that's it. Faith is my response to what God said. Why did Abraham pack his bags and go? Because God spoke. Why did Moses go down into Egypt and throw down the gauntlet of challenge in the palace of the great Pharaoh? Because God appeared and spoke at the burning bush and said, go. And he went because God spoke. It was faith, the human response to divine revelation. It's not wishful thinking. And some of you have heard me say 2,120 times that a man once told me, or I heard him say in a conversation, he said, in my opinion, faith is a step into the dark. Faith is screwing up your guts. And it's taking your stomach to believe something that your brain tells you is nonsense. That's not faith. That's just brainless folly. We don't admire that. Faith is not that kind of emotional, sentimental thing that makes me believe down here something that I know up there is absolutely false and futile. Faith is not, oh dear brothers and sisters, old and young and middle-aged and everybody else. Faith is not a step into the dark. Faith is a man taking a step out into the light that God has given. God speaks! And if I plant my feet on God's word, you can accept that that's no step in the dark. Now, what you say, boys, I tell you, if God spoke to me the way he spoke to Abraham, I would do some stuff. If God would speak to me the way he spoke to Moses, I would move the world. Listen, that's the point. That's the point. That's the point of Abraham. God has spoken to us in a way that he never spoke to Abraham. God has spoken to us in a way that he never spoke to Moses. And their arms folded, gazing into the sky, and just while away the hours, it's an absolute shame upon us, because men like Noah, Enoch, Abraham, Moses, Joseph, Isaac, Jacob, Samson, Deborah, Barak, David, a whole bunch of them, men like that did exploits for God, and they didn't have as much to go on as we have. What's Hebrews all about? He spoke in times past, bits and pieces. In these last days he has spoken unto us. In his Son. And the Son of God has been here. His blood has been shed. The tomb has been vacated. And the one who is the Son became the sacrifice. He's now back the priest upon the throne. And Hebrews says now, in light of that, it's up to us to act. God has revealed himself ultimately, finally. There's nothing more to say. And because we have received the final revelation, we are expected to act in faith. That's why it comes in at the end of this epistle. We've had earlier in these previous 10 chapters a full demonstration of God's redemption and God's revelation. And he says at the end of chapter 10, the just shall live by faith. Now chapter 11 opens with a verse that, well, for a long time it was a mystery to me. It tells us that faith is the substance of things not, of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And as a boy, and a fairly big boy at that, I wondered what on earth this is. Faith is the substance. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And I really didn't know what that verse meant. What sort of a substance is it? Is it a sort of an invisible jelly that is injected into our hearts or something like that? Faith is the substance. Now, it was the word substance that put me off and put me hunting down the wrong tunnel altogether. Because the word substance here and the Greek word that lies behind it, it's not talking about substance in the sense that I've used a jelly or rubber or something like that. It's a word that means what lies underneath the surface. It's a word that's the very opposite of image and the very opposite of exterior. It's talking about what's right down underneath. Actually, I think maybe our closest English word, and we put it in here, if you'll allow me, is the word reality. Now we bring that into the verse. Leave out the word substance altogether. And read the verse like this. Faith gives reality to things hoped for. That is, when a man has faith in his heart, it makes things real. So that a man lives in the reality of heaven long before he gets to it. That's faith. A man who has faith, he can reach out and he can take the things of eternity and bring them into time. And the things of eternity, they become real to him. He's not in eternity, the man. And the man's not in heaven. But the things of heaven and the things of eternity, they become absolute reality. And he looks at the little bits and pieces of time and earth. And he sees that these are only the furnishings on a stage that's about to collapse. And men are setting up the scenery. And they have everything propped up on the stage. And they make it lovely and they make it nice. And everybody's mesmerized with it. But the man of faith, he sees that this is just a show. He doesn't get excited. He looks to a bigger world. He says, I don't want the sham. And I'm not dissatisfied with the sham. He says, the things of earth and time won't do me. He says, I want the things of eternity and heaven. And they make them real. Faith makes them real. The evidence of things not seen. A man who lives by faith, he operates every day as if an unseen Christ was standing at his side. The evidence of things that the world can't see Christ. The world's going on just as if he never was here, as if he never was coming back, and as if he's presently not in heaven. They can't see him. We're living in an age, brethren and sisters, and this is very relevant to what I want to say later on. We're living in an age that is fascinated with the visible, the material, and the tangible. People are going crazy for things. Things that they can handle, things that they can touch, things that they can feel. We're in a very, very sensate. I'm not talking about sensual. We are too, but that's not the... We're in a very, very sensate or a very, very sensuous society. It depends great... A great deal depends on feeling, the feel-good factor. You see, a Christian's life's on a higher level because he's depending on faith. Not feeling. But of course, it's very possible for a Christian to drop down and become just very much in outlook and in perspective like the poor worldlings around us. But I hope that the Lord will preserve us, because faith is not only has a response to divine revelation, but faith has a sense of reality for things that are eternal. Now I could go through, well maybe I should just for a minute. You know, faith has results. And you only need to read this chapter to see it. Because these lives that were touched by faith, they were absolutely transformed. These men and women who lived by faith, they were totally different from their contemporaries. In their attitudes, in their actions, in their achievements, they were totally different from their contemporaries. Dear brethren and sisters, the problem is, in our attitude, in our ambitions, there's not that much difference between us and the worldlings. But these people were activated and motivated by a totally different principle. Now, in Hebrews 11, there are many ways of dividing it up. I'm not at all saying this is the only division, and I could maybe give you another division that would be very valid as well. But I see in Hebrews 11 there are four words. Now, just listen, and I know you're listening carefully, because I better get our hands on Moses or he'll get away on us altogether. But I'll come to this. I'll come to him. I'm still thinking about Moses. I haven't forgotten about... You know, the first word that I see in Hebrews 11 is the word before the flood. The word before the... What kind of a word was it? God said, he said, I can't put up with it any longer. He said, the violence and the vice, he said, they have reached, he said, the very pinnacle. Maybe I should say the very vortex. They had gone down as low as they could, and God said, the end of all flight. He said, I'm outraged. And he took the whole world and he dipped it in a bath. He was so outraged. It was a world of outrage. Has it changed much? You know, brethren and sisters, we still live in a world that outrages God with the things that are practiced and the things that are complimented and the things that are promoted. It's a world where God is outraged. The world before the flood, that's the first world. Then the second word that I see in Hebrews 11 is the word beyond the flood. You say, where was that? Well, that's the Old Testament expression that's used for Abraham. It says that God brought him from beyond the flood, not the flood of Noah, but the flood of the Euphrates. What kind of a word was it? A pleasure talk. It was the place to live. The lovely Euphrates Valley, the very cradle of civilization, when the half of the people were still living in mud huts, these people down in the Mesopotamian Valley, they had gorgeous and glorious cities. I tell you, there wasn't a place like it. If you could get there, you had made it. And do you see if you could become a citizen in one of those cities? I tell you, you had landed on your feet. You had made it for life. How did God get a man out of it? Oh, you see, you'll never get anybody out of there. If a person gets into one of those cities, this is not the world of outrage. This is not the world before the flood. This is the world beyond it. This is the world of opulence. In the beautiful Mesopotamian Valley, where much of the wealth of the world is stored, even to this present day, it's the world of fabulous opulence, and people just roll in luxury. And there was a man left at all. You see, he was a headcase. It was faith. Then the next word that I see in Hebrews 11 is the world around the flood. Not the flood of Noah, and not the flood of the Euphrates, but you know, there was a big flood. It was the flood of the Nile. I'm getting closer to Moses now, so forgive me. Just that Nile that came running right down, and you know it was it turned the very life fluid into the land of Egypt. And the irrigation of the Nile as it flooded those alluvial plains, it formed their employment, it formed their entertainment, it formed the part of their whole economy and their whole life, and they so loved this great big flooding Nile that they actually worshipped. But you know, there was one thing they didn't like. They loved the Nile, but they hated God's people. And they said, we'll get them to make bricks. And we'll give them a job, and they'll be so busy at their work, they'll be no good for God. And we'll make their burdens heavy. And we'll make their bricks planted. And we'll make their bondage tight, and they'll not have time to lift their heads, and they'll be so concerned about bricks, and they'll be so much concerned about the soil, that they'll never think about the sky. We've pushed them down. They're getting too big, and they're developing too much, so they said, the big Pharaoh said, we will crush them. This is not the world of outrage. This is not the world of opulence. This is the cruel world of oppression. It hasn't disappeared, brother. You know, I feel very sorry because I know that there are brethren, and they would, in this corner of their heart somewhere in about here, they would love to do their best in the assembly. And it's always pushing up to do more for God. And there's a clamor that I would like to be better for God, and I would like to be more spiritual, but they're caught in a job. And it's a great thing to have a job now, and I'm not telling you, but they're caught in a job. Maybe they've got a middle management post. And they're so much squeezed in their job. And Egypt has them so much trapped. Now, they can't leave their job. But Egypt has them so much trapped with burdens and bricks and bondage. The man that would love to do more for God when he gets home at night, he lifts his Bible and he just falls asleep. And he's to work on Saturday. And then he's practically no use on Sunday in the assembly. And he's finding great difficulty with the word of oppression. Then there's another word. The world before the flood, the world beyond the flood, the world around the flood. There's the world across the flood. It's a different world. You remember when the children of Israel just reached the end of their wilderness journey? They came to the River Jordan. And across the River Jordan there was a great world. The world of Canaan. But they're going to have a problem getting into that world because the Bible tells us that the Jordan had flooded. But there's a world across the flood. Eventually they get across. I'll not go into that tonight. And what do they get? As soon as they get across, what do they see? A massive, big, man-made fortification. No border. You're not getting in here. Neither you, nor God, nor the armies of Israel, you're getting no further. Do you not see the walls of Jericho? We put these walls up to tell you into our world, no entrance. This is the world of opposition. And they're not going to allow the people of God to enjoy their God-intended inheritance, and they're going to build bulwarks, and they're going to create obstacles, and this world across the flood is the world of opposition. Now what I haven't time to say this, just to balance it. What about the world before the flood, the world of outrage? How do you conquer it? You see, you haven't a chance. But you know there were two fellas, and that you know what it says about them? You know what it says about them? It just says the walk with God. That's nice. They didn't hop, skip, and jump. And they didn't run ahead of God, and they didn't lag behind God, but both Noah and Enoch, they just step by step, and stage by stage, and day by day, they just toddled along with God. Forgive that expression. They just walk with God. He dictated the pace. The world was racing mad. And they were going from one degree of violence and vice, from one degree to another, and lower. But these men just kept going on steady. Why? Faith. Faith. The consistency of faith was the answer to the world of outrage. Well, you say, what about this big world? You told us about the next world, the world across the flood, where we're building in Euphrates, those big cities like Ur of the Chaldees, and all those massive cities that are still famed and keep archaeologists digging, and they fill the chambers of the British Museum with artifacts that leave archaeologists absolutely amazed at the fabulous wealth of those, that ancient Sumerian civilization, and they're putting down their roots, and they're digging, and they're putting in their foundations, and they're building bigger and bigger and bigger and better and better, and nothing will ever. God says, tell you what. He says, you come out, he says, I want you to live in a tent. He said, Lord, what do you mean live in a tent? Live in a tent? And God got a man out of that when he was about 70, and he lived in a tent until he died about 100 years later. And he grumbled the whole time. Not at all, he was the happiest man on earth. Abraham. So if the answer to the world of outrage was the consistency of faith, men walk with God, the answer to the big world of opulence was just the contentment of faith. Content. Dear brethren, I'll tell you, they can't get it big enough nowadays. The building that's going on to me is crazy. They're building industrial estates, and they've got back to this idea of building big houses. They were away from it there for a while, and houses are bigger and better in their building. And if you had just put on an extension, I didn't hear about it. No, enjoy it. And thank the Lord for it. But you know, I'll tell you. And I'm not saying to sell your car and go back to a bicycle. And I'm not saying to sell your house and live in a caravan. That's not the point. God has blessed us. Thank God for every material blessing. But let us not become so obsessed with the things we forget the God that gave them to us. Be content with such things as ye have. See younger people here? Listen. I want to tell you. A plain home, a simple lifestyle, united with fellowship with God, will bring you more joy than living in a mansion and being a miser in your soul. Just the contentment of faith in the big world. What about the world of oppression? Well, we talk about the choice of faith. There's a man said, no more for me, I'm getting out of this. He says, I've had enough of it. He says, palace or no palace, he says, I'm getting out. He says, there's a people in this world that are more important to me than the palace. And he came to a day in his life, before he did it just now, and he said, this is it. And because he made a definite choice, by the choice of faith, he rose above the oppression of Egypt. What about the world of opposition? The big walls of Jericho. You say, well, now, I'll tell you boys, I doubt we'll have to nip back down to Egypt to see if we can get a few missiles made. God says, walk around this, he says, for days and blow trumpets and get them. See, these fellows are screwed loose all together. They'll never make any headway like this. They haven't a chance. We worked. Do you know people? It took us years to get these walls built. And we worked at it and we have got them built. But when up in years, God just demolished it in a lot of minutes. You know why? The conquest of faith. They just did what God told them. You know, brethren, I'll tell you, if we want to see the bastions of unbelief lowered, let us keep blowing the gospel trumpet. Just keep the trumpet and the bugle of the gospel to your lips and blow out the same. See, these fellows are screwed loose all together. They'll never make any headway like this. They haven't a chance. We worked. Do you know people? It took us years to get these walls built. And we worked at it and we have got them built. But when up in years, God just demolished it in a lot of minutes. You know why? The conquest of faith. They just did what God told them. You know, brethren, I'll tell you, if we want to see the bastions of unbelief lowered, let us keep blowing the gospel trumpet. Just keep the trumpet and the bugle of the gospel to your lips and blow out the same message clear and plain. And thank God we can say, if Paul was here, he would tell us that the weapons of our warfare, they're not carnal, but they're mighty through God to the pulling down of the strong force. So the contentment of faith, the consistency of faith, the conquest of faith, and here we are at last. This is God homiletics. Don't any of the younger brethren take a pattern from this. This is homiletics at the worst. But here we are right now, where I should have been a while ago, at the choice of faith. Now actually, I'm going to wander away again in a minute. Out of all these different references in Hebrews 11 to by faith, by faith, by faith, by faith, by faith, maybe 18 of them. The interesting thing is that just as the epistle mentions 10 times Abraham and mentions 10 times Moses, in this chapter, there's a larger paragraph for Abraham and a larger paragraph for Moses than any of the others. And 4 times it tells us about Abraham by faith. I'm following a revised version in one of the verses. Don't worry about that. 4 times it tells us about Moses by faith. Now, there's only one of those 4 has to do with his choice. But let me just mention what the other 3 are about, so that we get all this into context. Now, it says by faith, this is a man that, now this is the world of Egypt. This is the choice that will change the world of Egypt forever. This is the principle that is stronger than Egypt. And I feel, as I said already, dear brethren and sisters, that the world of Egypt is taking its toll upon us and is making us into brickmakers for Pharaoh instead of worshippers of God. Now, it says by faith, when Moses was just a little child, his parents had him. They conquered Egypt forever. Pharaoh said, we can't stop them being born. You know the story of the two midwives in Exodus 1. We can't stop these Hebrew boys, these Israelitish male children being born. But he says, I'll tell you what we will do. He says, if we can't stop them being born, he says, we'd make sure they don't grow. Has he changed? You know, if the devil can't stop, listen, especially a young believer here, I want to just put this into your mind in case you don't see what I'm getting at. You're saved. Thank God for that. Thank God for that. You'll never be in hell. Now, he tried his best. He tried his best. But the devil hasn't been able to stop you getting saved. But let me tell you, he does not say, oh, I've lost them. Oh, this is too bad. There's nothing I can do. I've lost them. If he hasn't been able to stop you getting saved, he'll do his best to stop you growing. That night that you trusted Christ, that wasn't you finished with the devil. You're no longer one of his slaves. You have been released and the chains of sin have been broken. And now with a new birth. You see, Moses was the second birth. I can't go back away into this because we'll be here all night at 12 o'clock and it says punctually here, so I don't know. I have to get this wee notice here shifted. Some of the time, if you see it missing, you'll search me going out to you'll know it's in my pocket. I want to get away with it. See, Moses was the second birth on the male line in the family of Amred and Jochebed. And the devil, Pharaoh said, we'll extinguish the second birth. You see, it's the second birth that gives the devil the power. The devil's happy enough with the first birth. But once there came into my life a second birth and the impartation with that birth of a new life, the devil says, we have to try. He says, get them into the river. Let them drip. Let them drown. Let them be devoured of crocodiles, whatever you like. Get them into the river. You know, I fear our river's Egypt's river. And we an awful lot of great young people. I feel for them. Are an awful lot of them drifting? Oh, they're saved, but they're drifting. Are there not quite a few of them drowning? They're getting into things that are far too deep for them. Are there not quite a few of them being devoured and crunched in the teeth of worldly crocodiles? There was a lady said, if I could help it, I'll not do it with an eye by. And she conquered Egypt's river by faith. Dear brethren, it's time that we stop the flow. And it's faith in God that will stop the flow that will carry away a generation. Then Moses. I'm going to touch him there. I'll come back to Moses. It says, by faith, he refused to. That's the second by faith. The first one by faith conquered the river. The second by faith, it says, he refused to be called the first son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasure. This man conquered Egypt's riches. If Egypt's river doesn't catch me, I need to watch its riches. Then it says, through faith, he abandoned Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. That's a mighty statement. There wasn't a man in the world with dare to challenge Pharaoh. He was the mightiest man in the world of that day. 1400 BC or whatever it was, the dispute about the date of the Exodus. I'm not going into that. I'm in enough trouble already. I'll not go into that just now. But I'll tell you this. He was the mightiest monarch in the world of that day. There wasn't a person would dare to say, boo!
Our Pharaoh said, die.
But there was one man came in one day, and he said, Pharaoh, I challenge this whole regime. He says, who are you? He says, who sent you to me? He says, the Lord. The Lord sent me. He says, who? Pardon? Who? He says, Jehovah. Who? He says, never heard of him. He says, never heard of him. He says, he never was about here. Who? Tell me again his name. Who? He says, I don't know him. He says, I don't know him. He says, I don't obey his voice. I don't even know him. And he says, you have permitted his name to tell me to change the whole politics of my country and to let the most of my work labor force go. He says, man, you haven't a chance. You know, when Pharaoh was blowing up bubbles at the Red Sea, there were about 2 million people standing in the banks singing, the Lord is a man of war. Jehovah is his name! And Pharaoh, if you said you didn't know who he was, you know now. And I tell you, Moses took a chance when he walked in that day and said, why did he do it? The faith that conquered Egypt's river and the faith that conquered Egypt's riches was the same faith that rose and challenged Egypt's ruler, a dictator. Yeah, well, it has to be done even to our day. Sometimes men by faith, Paul challenged the authority of Pharaoh, of Nero. Peter and James and John, they challenged the authority of the Sanhedrin. Men that live by faith in a living, risen Christ. I'm not saying that we become revolutionaries. I'm not saying that at all. But dear brethren, I'm saying this, that faith puts into a man's heart courage and conviction. What's the final one? The fourth one. It says through faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. What's that? Egypt's river. Egypt's riches. Egypt's ruler. This is Egypt's religion. You know, down in Egypt, they didn't believe in a blood religion. Down in Egypt, they worshipped living animals. Down in Egypt, they knew nothing about the value of sheltering and saving blood. Moses said, look, that's the way they worship. But he says, we are going to come out by the blood of the Lamb. My faith! Dear brethren, let us keep preaching the gospel of the precious blood of Christ. You see, there's a crossless Christianity that is very, very popular nowadays. And it gathers crowds and it makes things easy. And they would just very, very contemptuously describe the gospel of the Bible as the gospel of the slaughterhouse. But you know, we still preach Christ crucified. Let the world's religions go by faith. There's hope in nothing else. May we conquer earthly religion. It's faith. The river. Now, well, I better not go over it again. We get back to, by faith, Moses, when he was come to years. Now this choice, and I'm taking the second one of these four by faith, just the second one, and it'll be at least 20 to take I said that the other, our brother, I think was there one night away down in the south of Ireland, I told the folks just about this time, and there were three people got up and walked out. So I said to myself, Gilly, no more of the nonsense. Try and be sensible in front of an intelligent audience. Well, you folks know, I do my best to parcel this on. How this choice? Now, he didn't make this choice when he was a young fellow. Maybe just tossed about in a whirlpool of emotions and didn't just know. He didn't make this choice when he was an old fellow. And was on a walking here and couldn't enjoy Egypt anymore, say if I could just spend the rest of my days and I'll bury my well. When he was at his prime. When he was great. He knew what he was doing. There was nobody to advise him. There wasn't anybody to please but God. When he was great, it's not that he had the chance of becoming great. You know, sometimes we say about a man that goes into the Lord's work, as people tell us, oh, you know, he had a steady job. If he had a steady job, you wouldn't know where he'd have been. He'd have been prime minister in no time. That's it. If he would have, it's very hypothetical. This wasn't a matter that Moses had stayed in Egypt. He would have gone to the top. Moses was at the top. When he was great, he had it. So that he made this choice from a position of responsibility. That adds weight to it. He made this choice in the full possession of his adult and his mature powers. But he never regretted it. Dear brethren, this wasn't something done in the impulse of emotion. He didn't go to a good ministry meeting and just get wafted away on a kind of a touchy feeling and feel I'll have to give up all for God. And he just was wafted over the bar by emotions. No, there was far more to it than that. It was a responsible choice. The second thing I want to say about the choice, it involved a refusal as well as a responsibility. He refused. He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. To be called. You see, in the ancient world, when a person was adopted, as Moses was, the new adoption, maybe to a large extent in our day too, the new adoption legally cancels all the ties with the old family. You know, there were ties in this man's heart that no legality could cancel. All the grandeur of the palace of Egypt, all the glory of the pyramids, all the glamour of Pharaoh's great regime, all the beauty and the finery of Egyptian vices that rested upon his shoulders. Oh, I tell you all the gold that surrounded this man and was just lying like a river at his feet. He said there was something about a people there, and he said, I feel more at home there than I do in here. The Bible tells us that God put it into his heart. It just came into his heart. I love what Stephen says. It came into his heart to visit his brother. I think when Moses went out that day and he stepped off the golden floor of Pharaoh's palace and eventually hit the dust and dirt of the brickmakers, he wasn't with them 5 minutes and he felt these are my people. It revived within his whole soul a whole heritage and a bonding of brotherhood. He says, these are my people. You know, some of you brethren, I know that you have good jobs, that's great. And I know that you're rubbing shoulders with men that are exceedingly intelligent, and you're sitting in offices that are well furnished, and you're surrounded by fax machines and telephones and computer screens and the whole business, and that's great. I'm not complaining about it at all. You have to move there for your daily living and your employment and get a loaf of bread and one or two other things. That's grand. Then you come on Sunday morning and it's just a simple table. And it's a loaf of bread and a cup. And you look around and there are a few folks, just the ordinary folks. And you can tell me from your heart you feel far more at home with them than you do with the managing directors in the big mess. But your people. Oh, love them. Oh, you say, but you are a canoscious crowd. Sure he wasn't right out till he saw two of them fighting. You know, Moses got beneath the little surface ripples. He says, they're my brother. He chose rather to suffer affliction. They're even better than my brother. He says, they're God's people. Suffer affliction. This was linked with not only a responsibility, with a refusal. It was linked with a rather. Choosing rather to suffer affliction with God's people and to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Oh, I tell you, is there something about this? I would love, dear brother, where are your priorities? You see that little group of people in the assembly? You know they need you. You've got a healthy body. You've got a sharp mind. You've got many faculties, God endowed. Can I appeal to you tonight? Don't use it all for this world. It says that Moses saw their burden. Ah, I like that. I always look to see, even in a young brother, that he feels for the burdens of the Lord's people. You know, young brother, I want to tell you, I maybe haven't always practiced it. And the brethren were very forgiving. But you see, the Christians in the assembly, they have enough burdens to start with. You do your best to conduct yourself in such a way that you don't add to them. And if God would only put it in your heart and give you an opportunity, you say, by the grace of God, I'll do my best to relieve the burdens of these people. He chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin. Now, I know we preach in the gospel of it, drink and drugs and all that sort of stuff. And all of this, and preach away at that. That'll be great. If you can reach a target with that, I'll be very happy. I don't think that's in it at all. I don't think Moses was saying, if I better go to these people rather than take the drink and all in the palace. Do you really think Moses was really worried about wine, women, and songs they talk about in the world? Not at all. There's still the pleasures of sin in that. Listen. How will I put it? God had showed this man a path for the people. And if he had stayed in the luxurious life of the palace, it would have been a sin. You know, there comes a time, listen now, you say, I know there comes a time, but there comes a time when a legitimate pleasure that in itself is not sinful, it can become sinful. Because when I'm dabbling in it, if I was living by faith, I would be engaged in a higher calling. Suffer hardship. Now listen, we love the soft life. We love the soft life. That's the pleasures of sin. The softness of the palace. The luxury of the palace. All that kind of thing. You see, we're living in a world, brethren and sisters, I was talking about it in the conference a little bit, where people have developed an awful craving for just hobbies and happiness and holidays and anything that's fun or demanding or requires commitment and is going to tie you down. Give me my freedom. People nowadays just work for the weekend. People want to work shorter hours for more money so that they can have greater leisure. You see, an older generation of people. Now listen, I'm telling you, I'm not an old antique, and I'm not wanting to go way back as I say. You see, older Christians that didn't travel half as far as we travel, and they didn't have the holidays that we have, and they didn't have the homes that we have, they didn't have the cars that we have, and they didn't have this, that, and that, and they had to live a much simpler life. Some of them never missed a meeting. And some of them were at every assembly meeting 52 weeks in a year, and they were as happy as heaven could make them. And we are trying to be in New York, and trying to be in Lanzarote, and trying to be in the South Sea of the Moon, and all that kind of thing, and trying to combine Christianity with it as well, and we just can't manage it! And we have made ourselves a bunch of spiritual neurotics. We're doing the spiritual splits. And we love a soft life, and we love to be mollycoddled. And we love to have it all. You know, Paul said to Timothy, he says, Timothy, you forget about the soft life. He says, you endure hardness. He says, not in the barracks. He says, get into the battle. And he says, tighten your belt. And he says, you be there and take the rough and tumble. And he says, endure hardness. Dear young brother, I'll say, I'm not begrudging a holiday, not at all, that's not the point of my remarks, but I'll say this. Don't be afraid to get involved in things. Don't you be afraid to take your share of heavy work. Don't you be afraid to take a Sunday school class in case you've been tied down. Don't you be afraid to entertain a preacher in case it will be too limiting. No, we don't keep anybody in our house. That's what we did, you know. See all that? That's the very life that Moses gave up so that he could associate with a bunch of brickmakers. But they were God's people. Oh, they're God's people. That broke a man's heart. See, that broke a man's heart. They must have put grey hairs on his head if he had any. They didn't put his eyes out anyway. But they must have broken his heart. And I tell you, he gave up. Choosing rather than, what about this? Esteem it. This is his reckoning. Responsibility and the choice. The refusal and the choice. The rather of the choice. The reckoning of the choice. He esteemed the reproach of Christ. Greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. Not the treasures of Egypt. The treasures in Egypt. There were a lot of treasures in Egypt that weren't of Egypt. You see, Egypt, even to go back into the Bible times, Egypt, in the days of Joseph, and the famine and so on, Egypt became the breadbasket of the world. And for bread, the surrounding nations had to come in by droves and bring their money in to get bread. So that really the wealth of the world, it poured into Egypt. Now, they weren't all Egyptian treasures. They weren't all the treasures of Egypt. But I tell you, the wealth of other nations was to be found in Egypt. So it was all there. It wasn't only the bread basket of the ancient world. It was the great bank of the ancient world. And Moses had it all. Didn't even have to write a check. He didn't need a credit card or anything. He never got Moses standing at the hole in the wall, taking out 50 packets. the man had millions in his hip pocket. You say, well, now you're going to be a good accountant, my man. You've been brought up. He says, yes, this is my accountant. He says, the reproach of Christ means more to me than all the treasures in Egypt. This is bigger than that. This is a man who not only appreciates a people. That was the previous verse. This man now has got a glimpse of a person. It's Christ. He says, it's Christ. It's the Messiah. I'll tell you, brethren, you see in assembly life and in the choices of life, when things are going tough and rough, there's nothing but keep you steady in the storm like just appreciating. These are God's people. And this is Christ's assembly. It's Him, and it's them. And the weak count every earthly thing as just dross. He had respect unto the recompense of the reward. The reward of this choice. You know, some of our choices, well, they haven't much reward, and I'll just finish. I'll stop, because this thing is far more than it. I would want to go away on and on into this, but just His reward. What was the reward? I don't know. I just don't know how you talk about it. You see, the day that he stood on the banks of the Red Sea and he heard the choir singing, I think he said it's worth it all. You see, if you put your best into the assembly and you see the joy of God's people, you see, the day he built the tabernacle and saw the cloud come down, he says, the pyramids of Egypt compared to this, they were only scrap. He says, it's worth it all. You see, the day he went into the valley of Moab and the Lord himself conducted the funeral service, he says, I would rather rest in this on the floor of a valley in Moab than rest in one of the vaults of Egypt. You know, you might have been going to the British Museum to see a mummy with Moses' name on it. Dear help us. God help us.
He was just buried by the hand of, you see, the day that he stood on the Mount of Transfiguration with Christ.
The recompense of the reward.
Do you see, brethren and sisters, a million years from tonight, it's still be rewarded.
It'll go on, and on, and on, and on, and when the silks and sands of time have long since covered every relic of the Egyptian Empire, the reward of Moses will shine for eternity.
Let us put our best foot forward. Let us make our choices. Now you make your choice, brother. Tell me, when you make your big choices in life, are they dictated by finance, by family, by friends, by fear, by faith? They'll wobble. May God help us to make choices dictated by faith. Shall we pray? Our Father, we commend to Thee Thy word. We thank Thee for the patience of Thy people with this extended meeting, and we ask Thee to grant that some of these great principles will trickle into our hearts and will inform our preferences and will help us to make choices, intelligent choices, wise choices, in light of eternity in days to come. We ask for Thy mercy. We thank Thee for all who are present, and pray a blessing upon the life of every believer and upon our journeys now in the remaining part of this day, as we render thanks in the Savior's precious name. Amen. Just one verse, and I do apologize for this thing, but verse 84, sorry, hymn number 84, Lord Jesus, Friend Unfailing. And the only verse that we'll sing tonight is verse 4, O worldly pomp and glory, your charms are spread in vain. I've heard a sweeter story. I found it through her key. In the fourth verse of 84, and I would ask you to stand and sing.